From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, one family's story of living through the grind of the boom-bust cycle of West Texas that leads to a multi-generational epic centered in Big Spring. Life through the eyes of a child born in Mexico, assimilating in McAllen, and wondering where his place is in the world of borders. And how the fictional tale of a family with odd superpowers reflects the superpower of the family itself. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The city of Big Spring is the seat of Howard County in West Texas. It has a population of about 30,000, but that number rises and falls with the price of crude oil. It's the largest municipality between McAllen to the west, Abilene to the east, Lubbock to the north, and San Angelo to the south. It's also where the Mueller family ended up, the bloodline of journalist and writer Brian Mueller, who is known for his war reporting in Africa and his bestseller, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. His latest book is The Kings of Big Spring, God, Oil, and One Family's Search for the American Dream. Mueller tells us the research and writing of the book helped him understand his family, their struggles, and the forces that made their lives so difficult.
Going into my history, going and walking the dirt that my great-grandfather walked on and farmed on, walking on the dirt of the farm that he lost at the bank, walking on the ground that... where he died, where my the oil fields, where my granddad labored. And those places, it really put me in connection with those people, and now I see my family differently. I see my family in a completely different way. I'm not talking about not just my father and my mother, but there's this chain that's connected to them now, into these kind of nether reaches of history that were invisible to me before, but I know now. I have these roots now. These roots are evident to me now. And I think we pay attention to these people because they tell us who we are. And if you don't know where you've been, it's hard to know where you're going. And so that has been the most useful thing for me. And also, I'm politically opposite from most of my family. My family are very conservative. I'm not, and I've long had to defend my political beliefs as a Democrat at the dinner tables and elsewhere against my family, And it's very useful now that I have this deeper connection with them, especially in this age of Trump, that I can see them as people, rather than as somebody who voted for this man, and so I'm able to separate the people from the politics. So I'd say it's also useful for me in that regard.
What do we need to know about these people?
This country, well, this world, especially this economy. Is ruled by forces that most of us don't understand or don't see coming, especially right now with economic inequality so great, where 1% of the population owns 82% of the wealth. It's useful to know who these people are, especially in these hyper-politicized times. If you notice, I didn't politicize my family in this book. I didn't romanticize them, but I certainly didn't politicize them, and that was on purpose because when we talk about blue collar people or worker or working class or whatever term you want to use that we reference these people by, when we talk about them, it's usually through a political lens. These are Trump supporters, or they live in red states, they're in flyover states, they're forgotten, whatever cliches that we use to describe people who work for a living.
So we have drought, and we have Dust Bowl, and we have the Depression, and there's even a flood in your story. These are not much the difference between natural disasters and man-made economic disasters catching these people and putting them in an early grave sometimes through overwork. Mm-hmm. They have nowhere to turn except work harder and try to survive and hang on. It's a story of hard work, a stoic class. And so it's not hard to imagine why they make the political choices that they do. There's not a whole lot of room for luxury for them.
Yeah, and one thing that my family did, and I think a lot of people do in their situation, well, they are very religious people. My family, in the worst of the Depression, embraced Pentecostalism. And Pentecostalism and its message of salvation was anathema. I mean, it was a remedy, and it was freedom from the way that they were living. It was a safety net for the people who had lost children in these floods, like my family had, lost them to horrible accidents, had lost their farms, had lost their homes. My great grandmother died along the road somewhere after they were evicted from their farm, and they, you know, buried her on the road somewhere. I have yet to find her grave. So, you know, my family was carrying around these burdens and these tragedies, and to come into the church, a body of people who wept with you when you were sad, who fed you when you were hungry. You know, we didn't have a social safety net like we do now, in terms of government support. So, back then it was the church, and the church also not only just helped them physically, but it also helped them spiritually. It lifted them up. My grandmother Opal was a singer, and so she would sing in these choirs, and that's how they found their release. They would all get around the piano or a guitar after church on Sunday night or Friday night, and they would just sing for hours and hours and hours. And this was a release. This was it was to be in communication with God and the Holy Spirit, or what have you. But it was a release for them, and it led to them having a joyous life in the midst of all this pain.
It helped them make sense of some of these issues.
Yeah, exactly.
They would attribute the woes to either their own sort of strain from the faith, or maybe someone else in the families. You know, why are these things happening to us? Mm-hmm. And the church might provide an answer.
Right. Or if it didn't give you an answer, there were people just like you who were asking the same questions.
So the boom bust issue. Okay. So it seems like that the feeling is that the bust is the natural state and the boom is the unnatural state. And that when we're in the boom, that we see the activity of sort of a self-destructive lavishness that's underway. And is that what the characters perceive?
Yeah, I like the way you characterize that. The bust is certainly the natural state. And when the boom is happening, for some reason, you're flying too high to realize that you're going to come down again.
So it's the
Icarus.
When you
come down again, it's a hard landing. And it happens again and again. I think this recent boom was a little bit more tame. But you know, there's still the same trappings of older booms. There's a lot of drugs and a lot of people spending their money on useless stuff and people going broke. And, you know, it's all there. You just got to drive through West Texas right now and you'll see it. You'll see guys pulling brand new boats when there ain't a body of water around for like 100 miles. But, you know, it's there. There will be a bust again. We always revert back to our natural state. But once when we're in our unnatural state, we have a very, we're very good at numbing ourselves to the reality of what's to come.
You're giving a multi-generational story, okay? We don't have a single character who brings us all the way through your story, The Kings of Big Spring. We have to look at it through a long-time lens. And the people who live in Big Spring, and they've seen the base, the web, Air Force Base shut down and other big employers move away and the Big Spring didn't spring anymore. For them to read your book and see the story of their place, what do they tell you?
I've gotten really great feedback from people in Big Spring. And I, you know, of course, they were the people I was most nervous to read it because people have lived in that town long enough. They know its history. And you better not get it wrong, but a lot of people who are older, older men and women, who lived through a lot of that stuff with my family, they really enjoy the book, and I think it does with them what it has done with my own family, which is it puts their own lives in the context of history, because we have all these memories. But they're scattered, and they're not cohesive. There's not a line that connects them at all. And so, you know, in my family, we knew we lost that farm, but we didn't know why we lost that farm. And so, when you lose a farm like that, and you lose your land, it's kind of embarrassing. You feel ashamed of that, and that shame carries down through the generations. My grandpa always said we had the Miller luck, something that my dad would refuse to accept. And so when I come around and I say, well, you know, we lost that farm because there was this drought that was hitting and everybody was losing their farm. And there was this guy, Frank Day, that actually stole our farm from us. And there was an oil boom, the Ranger oil boom, that was kicking off 10 miles from this farm. And so you put these pieces together, and it all makes sense. When our family talks about losing our cattle trucks in the late 50s, you know, that's a shameful thing too. They lost their trucks, they lost their house, but they lost it because, you know, the work left, the work was gone. And so when you put these things in the context of history, and you see how we ride the booms up and we ride them down. But we always come out on the other end, you know. It really reframes our whole lives for us, you know. And this is what I was kind of talking about when I said that I look at my family differently now. And I think all of our family looks at our, like after this book, because my family didn't know anything about where we were from or what had happened to us until I started doing the research. And I think we're all kind of looking at the past from a new perspective.
Brian Miller is the author of the book, The Kings of Big Spring, God, Oil, and One Family's Search for the American Dream. He's also the author of Muck City, All Things Must Fight to Live, and The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. The Bible tells us it's the fool who builds his house on sand. According to the parable, the rains will come and the house will be washed away. But what about a house built on ashes? Who builds a house there? According to Texas writer Jose Antonio Rodriguez, that's where the poor live. At least that's where his family built their house when he was born in a village in Mexico. Rodriguez tells his story in a series of vignettes in his memoir, House Built on Ashes. He says it's the story of a child trying to make sense of the world where he is the other.
Dislocation, a sense of alienation for different reasons. But I do believe that the overriding reason, poverty, is I think class is sort of at the center of this narrative.
The story is of you as a child born in Mexico, other side of the Rio mm-hmm. Grande, and you come across and you experience life in McAllen. Always there is dealing with the deprivations of living in that area and mm-hmm. and the relative poverty, you know, depending, and I don't mean that, sometimes it is your relative's poverty, but it is also your own as a relative, but mm-hmm. also in comparison.
Right.
And so there's a lot of that going on.
I wanted to sort of create a kind of a mosaic of a life and a sort of developing consciousness in the middle of really difficult material circumstances, right? And to try and communicate to the reader, among other things, the way that the material circumstances of one's life can shape our sense of self, can influence our sense of self, and in very kind of limiting ways, right? The narrator's mother, my mother, but I would like to speak of myself in the third person when talking about the book. The narrator's mother is very unlike the father, who's very kind of seems to be very sort of more laid back and more I guess more sure of himself. The mother is not. There's a kind of shame around poverty that she communicates to the narrator and that she kind of instills in the narrator, and this idea of always feeling like you're at the wrong, in always on the sort of on the wrong side of the binaries between language, between class, the binary of sexuality, the binary of culture, and always feeling sort of like an outsider, lacking, a lot of lack. It begins as material, but then it quickly becomes, I think, also social, right? Mental, emotional.
House built on ashes, to me, it seems to be you're talking about how that's the title of the book, how you have to create an identity, a self, based upon what came before, and that you have to set that ablaze. There's a destructive process to get to where you are today. Is that true?
So you mean by a destructive process as in a deliberate destructive process on the part of the narrator, or kind of a destructive process in society from which the narrator then has to kind of survive or make the best of?
The protagonist in the story had to become an American, and in that process, there was a destruction of his Mexicanness.
To a certain degree, yeah, there's an undoing of that. There's a at least a sort of a process of alienation, yes, from the in the narrator from his own past, yes. In language and all that.
So the book, you explore the otherness, particularly of being of born in Mexico and coming across and trying to fit in into the Rio Grande Valley on the American side. But now, in today's political climate, where that particular otherness is being made so toxic with our leading politicians, and do you think that the story that you tell now is coming at a particular time that really needs to be told? That, because we see this through the gentle eyes of a child.
Yes, that was certainly deliberate on my part. For the longest time, it's been really right. It's never been easy being poor. So there's class issues there that precede our current political climate that have been around for a long time. But the way poverty has been politicized, recently, for example, with the conversations around universal health care, politicians talking about people who quote unquote did things right and therefore are healthy, as opposed to people who quote unquote did things wrong, i.e., poor people who don't have health care and somehow deserve their own illnesses. That kind of conversation, in addition to, of course, yeah, the whole the arguments over geopolitical borders that are very overt now, makes, I think, yeah, my memoir quite timely and necessary. And yeah, specifically the voice of a child, a developing consciousness, how all this acts on him in his very marginalized situation, yeah, in so many ways. And
Well,
hopefully it evokes in the reader some sort of, yeah, you know, some sort of, I don't know, they can see at least partially themselves in it, the idea of how we all struggle to, in some way, to create a sense of self, and how important are the markers around us, like place and like family and like school and language, that help to that when those are stable, right, help the self create a stable identity. And when they're not, then it creates a lot of trauma.
how are the others, your contemporaries, who have gone through the same experience. Not all of them have had the ability to go off and get fellowships and learn the craft right. of writing and have the voice. I would just right. be really interested to see how they feel about that story.
Being the youngest of the family, there's artists tend to be the younger siblings in the family. And I imagine it's because on some level, because they're the youngest, they have more parenting around them. They're allowed to dream a little bit more. They're a little bit more coddled than, say, the older siblings who have to start parenting at a young age, their younger siblings, in order to help out in very large families. So I think part of that allowed me to dream maybe a little bit more, to indulge my fantasies a little bit more eventually. I always dreamt of being a writer, but it wasn't really kind of like I didn't allow myself to actually acknowledge that until very later in my life, because writers, I was taught that indirectly or sometimes explicitly, that writers didn't come from where I came from, right? That writers didn't come from Mexican villages. That's why it took me a while. But at the same time, look, I think one of the things that allowed me to be able to develop my voice and sort of pursue that dream of being a writer is I have to say, it is my queerness. Because I think had I been straight, I probably would have like gotten married and had the children and settled down and gotten the good paying job that my high school counselor wanted me to get. And that would have been that, but my queerness never quite allowed me to fit in even at that level. And so I was estranged even at home. Say I felt like a minority even at home. So even home was not fully home for me, not certainly when I was in the closet. So that kind of, I think, that kind of separation allowed me to see the world differently than those around me. And also, of course, I was very fortunate. You know, I was very fortunate to be kind of like good at school and to have teachers who championed me, to develop a self that really wanted to please them, because I craved praise so much, right? Or I needed it so badly.
In such an uncertain world. The book is about the child processing the world, very confusing world. Mm-hmm. And that uncertainty is that you were definitely looking for any kind of acknowledgement that, yeah, you were doing it right.
Right. Well, I was wrong in so many ways, it seemed. I was not acting right in the playground. I was not acting right at home. I was not, you know, happy the way I dressed. I was not happy about the way I looked. I was not happy in so many ways. But I was good at school, and the teachers didn't bully me, so I gravitated towards them. I think that set me apart in some way. So I was good at being a student, and so therefore, I wanted to be a student as long as I could.
Jose Antonio Rodriguez is the author of House Built on Ashes, a memoir. He is a professor in the creative writing program at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He has also written Shallow End of Sleep and Backlit Hour. Do you know anyone with abilities so sublime that they seem like a superhero? That describes the way a lot of us see members in our own family, people motivated by good intentions who make their way through life in the service of others. And families can also be dysfunctional. In Lady Hubbard's debut novel, we see the ways that families embody the very best and heroic qualities as they make their way in a flawed and trying world. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides has a review of Lady Hubbard's The Talented Ribkins.
In The Talented Tenth, sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois asserted his prescription for guiding African Americans from a position of disempowerment to one of collective empowerment. And as he put it, that required, quote, moving the mass away from the contamination and death of the worst in their own and other races. It's not that he was opposed to technical school or trade school, but he believed there must be a system of education for African Americans too, just like the systems that benefited and continue to benefit white Americans. The essay was published in 1903, and still today, 115 years later, its ideas hold up as everything from a social justice principle, a controversial polemic, and grist for the creative mill of writers. Okay, now, with that history lesson out of the way, have you heard of the Justice League? Yes, that comic book Justice League of Superheroes. No, not the Du Bois Talented Tenth. This time it's a riff, it's Ripkins. We meet a family of black crusaders whose central goal during the civil rights movement was to protect those talented members of the black community, the leaders and activists who led the way to righteousness through fighting for equity and justice. Yeah, that's a tall order, particularly when you consider that the protagonist in the novel is 72-year-old Johnny Ripkins, who's not only taking care of his 13-year-old niece Eloise, but also eluding a mob boss's henchmen. Yes, oh, how the mighty do fall. But the drop is not as precipitous as all that. The Ripkins have skills. Aiding them in their work with what they named the Justice Committee were good intentions, their intelligence, and wits, and, well, superpowers of a type. They weren't famous civil rights leaders. Their self-imposed job was to protect the civil rights leaders, those talented tenth of the African American community. Their superpowers aren't exactly of the Marvel Comics ilk. They're a milder version of those sublime abilities. One has an unparalleled acute sense of smell, which makes him a rib king. One spits firecrackers. There are family members named Flash and Hammer, for reasons one can easily imagine, and the list of idiosyncratic characters goes on and on. Johnny himself is a map maker, but not in the sense of cartography. He can make maps of any place he has been and even any place he has never actually seen. His goal is to make four-dimensional maps involving the element of time. In order to achieve his goal, he breaks away from the family unit that is already set to disband. The break leads him to desperate measures to survive without them and dire straits when he's implicated in a particularly dark episode in this mob world. Decades later, when Johnny's brother Franklin, who has superpowers like Spider-Man, dies, Johnny returns to his home and discovers that Franklin had a daughter, 13-year-old Eloise. And yes, she won that DNA lottery. Her superpower is she can catch anything that is thrown at her. Literally at first, even in the dark or even when her eyes are closed, and later, figuratively. But Johnny isn't there to visit the girl. He's after loot buried there in Franklin's house long ago, there and throughout Florida in the backyards of various estranged family members. And that's how the unlikely pair of Johnny and Eloise set out on this unusual buddy road trip story that's the central narrative of this novel. As we move from point to point on Johnny's latest map, we meet more Ripkinsons, each character even more fascinating and rich than the last. Resonant for that is the family dysfunction we can all understand and own, from its petty thoughtlessness to sharper misdeeds, but also to its glimmers of nostalgia, unassailable loyalties, and incontestable forgiveness. Du Bois wrote, "If your talents as a leader emerge, you have to have the vision to use those talents for the benefit of your community." In that case, author Lady Hubbard's talents as a leader and a novelist emerge with a superb, riveting tale and an unforgettable cast of sympathetic characters. Her vision seems wider than the scope of one single community. The novel defies definition and genre, transcends race, and, just as Johnny Ripkins dreamed, transcends time itself.
Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. She reviewed The Talented Ripkins by Lady Hubbard. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.